everyone. Welcome back to I See What You're Saying, the Disciplined Listening Podcast. I'm Michael Reddington, and today it is my pleasure to welcome our next guests, retired detectives and former partners while on the job, Tom McGreal and Joanne Ryan. And they are joining us today to talk about not just how they were so successful with investigations and interviewers, but what made their partnership so successful as well. Because one way or another, we all have communication partners at home and in our jobs, and there's so much from their experience that we can learn as well. Tom is a retired detective with Chicago Police, where his assignments included, but are not limited to, the homicide, gang crimes, and special operations units. After retiring from Chicago PD, he went over to the state's attorney's office, where he was assigned to the post-conviction and complex prosecution units. Tom has been a student of interview and interrogation for his entire career and has taught innumerable interviewing and investigation classes himself. Joanne is also a retired detective and investigator. She worked 10 years in the probation office for Cook County, Illinois, before moving over to the state's attorney's office and being partnered up with Tom in the post-conviction and complex prosecution units. She also worked in the human trafficking unit as well. Both Tom and Joanne are certified forensic interviewers. Both are students of their craft and have so many amazing examples to share with us today. Really, what we're going to focus a lot of this conversation around is what made their partnership so successful and how can we apply those lessons to our business and personal lives as well. So they'll talk about the importance of shared values. They'll also talk about the importance of capitalizing on their different perspectives. They'll talk about how they navigated interviews and investigations together, how they learned lessons from each other, how they supported and built each other up. And they've got a bunch of great stories that they're going to share from their career during the conversation as well. So we thank them for taking the time to join us. And we certainly thank you all for taking the time to be here and listen today as well. Thank you so very much. We know you know our sponsors. Head over to humantel.com. That's where you can enter the code INQUASIVE25 for 25% off the best in-class online training to understand when people's emotions are shifting by accurately evaluating changes in their facial expressions and nonverbal communication. For the professional interviewers, please head over to certifiedinterviewer.com. That's where you can learn more about the International Association of Interviewers. That's also where you can learn more about how you can obtain your certified forensic interviewer designation. And please, while you're online, head over to inquasive.com to learn more about the programs our clients ask us to customize and facilitate for their senior leaders, sales teams, and HR teams to teach them how to obtain the everyday confessions that are hiding in all of their conversations. Thank you once again for being here for another week and another great conversation. So without further ado, I introduce to you, Tom and Joanne.
Joanne, you have to
help me. Morning, Tom and Joanne. It is so great to see you both. I really appreciate you taking the time to be here this morning. How are you doing?
Very good. Thanks for inviting us. We appreciate it. It's a new experience for the two of us.
Yep. All good on this end, Mike. And good to see you, Tom.
You too.
Well, I really appreciate you guys being here. I am honestly excited for this conversation. I think a lot of times when we think about communication, we think about who we have to communicate with, and those can be professional relationships, which I feel like people often think like senior subordinate type relationships. We can be at home with our families, everything in between. But you two worked as partners in law enforcement together. And I have had the privilege to get to know you both over the years. And Tom, you and I worked together for several years. And having conversations with you both over the years, I'm really thankful to have the opportunity to dive in and not just learn more about how you work together and Joanne, how you managed to work with Tom, but I'm really, really excited to share with everybody else. You know, what makes it really work? It's not just a TV show. It's not drama. But every day out there, how do partners really work together to resolve investigations, get the truth, support each other, the whole piece? So before I just rant about how happy I am to talk to you both for another hour, Tom, if you don't mind getting us started, I know it's been a few years since you've worked together, but could you walk us through your partnership? And then Joanne, I'll obviously ask you to chime in as well, but how you work together to the degree that you can share the types of cases you worked on, and then we'll take the conversation from there.
I'd be glad to, Mike. Thanks for asking. Prior to working with the state's attorney's office, that's where Joanne and I worked together. I was a Chicago police man. I retired as a detective in 2006. During my career, I worked with many, many partners. Some I got along with, some I didn't. Some lasted months, others lasted years. But I did notice that there was a trend with the partners I worked with that most of the partners were very dominant in personality. Conducting interviews and interrogations, a dominant person is going to want to take the lead. Now, that dominant person expects you to be submissive and to take a lesser role, but to follow direction. This presents a problem, and which sometimes you could see it with other partners, when you find two dominant persons and they're both fighting for airtime and they're talking over each other. They're missing the responses to the questions asked. Sometimes they assume guilt. Both parties assume guilt. And it just doesn't make for a real productive interview or interrogation. So I was fortunate. I did work, especially after I made detective, with a lot of very knowledgeable police detectives. And I learned a lot. But also, they were about 10 years older than me. Every unit I ever worked in, there was about a 10-year difference. You know, so naturally, they would be leading the interviews, investigative interviews. I left the police department in 2006. And prior to that, one of my final jobs, I was in detective training. I was creating classes and teaching newly appointed detectives. This is where I met Joanne. Joanne and her partner and other state's attorneys came to our class. They were permitted into the class, and Joanne has the title not only of detective, but also as investigator. And not many people have that title. We got along during the class. We spoke to each other, but after I left the police department, we saw each other periodically in court. Joanne and her former partner were in the hallways as we're going from courtroom to courtroom or to our assignments, and we spoke and we got along. When I was assigned to the state's attorney's office, it was my original assignment was in general. It's a general assignment where you work for the state's attorneys. You do, they tell you they might want subpoenas served. They might want people located. They, whatever they need for their court cases, that was my assignment for today. Probably in January, towards the end of January in 2007, I was assigned to the post-conviction unit. Joanne was also in that unit with her partner. Her partner was getting promoted and leaving. That's a big reason why a lot of partnerships end, is because one gets promoted, the other doesn't stand in the way of promotion, and their life continues, but it's just a different assignment. Joanne and I were working on a specific case at the time, and a post-conviction case, and we needed assistance on certain calls. So Joanne agreed to go with me on one assignment, which she will laughingly tell you that she thought I knew the whole city, but I really didn't. That anything north of Madison Street, you know, I had to pull out my police book and look up the streets. But we got along fine, and we decided to work together as partners. Now, in a state's attorney's office, it's not unusual they have partnerships, but there isn't a lot of partners. But we were very successful. We were very successful in our cases, and that's kind of went on from that point.
That's awesome. I appreciate you cluing us into how the initial relationship was established and how you started working together. Obviously, I would love to dive in and ask a little bit more about how you learned the city, what you didn't know. But Joanne, let me kick it over to you for a second, because it sounds like, and we know each other a little bit, so hopefully if I make a joke, it's not too far out of turn, but it sounds like you worked so hard that your first partner got promoted.
Yeah.
And then as a reward / punishment, you got stuck with Tom.
With Tom, yes. Who doesn't know the north side.
So I'm curious, when you guys worked that first case together, what was your initial thought or response to working with Tom? Because I'm sure, like in any relationship in life, when you're used to working with somebody, there's patterns that are established. And then when those patterns are gone and you establish new patterns, what was it like as you and Tom started working together?
So my partner, we were partners. I had a female partner and we were partner for a few years in the post-conviction unit, which is a unit that reinvestigates old cases. Most of the times people would have actual innocence claims. So there was a lot of interviewing in this unit. So my previous partner, she was actually going on, it was a promotion, but she was going on to like another extensive training. And so meeting Tom, so we had a history, we met in the academy. And so when he and I partnered up on that day, I'm like, you know, he's so tall. He's just intimidating. I mean, he's a big teddy bear, but he's intimidating if you don't know him. And so we partnered up to go on the north side to find someone. And I think we both just made assumptions about each other. I'm like, oh, he's this, you know, big city detective, retired. He must know everything about Chicago because I'm originally from New York. So I didn't have the luxury. I came to Chicago after college. So I didn't have the luxury of knowing the streets. But I learned, you know, I was a probation officer previously and then as an investigator. So on this particular day, we took the assignment, got in the car, and I think Tom was driving that day. And I just assumed he's driving. He knows where we're going. And he assumed I'm young. I should know the city. So we just made those assumptions and we kind of laughed about it. I think we found our person. And just the other day, Tom and I were talking about our first assignment together. And he remembered that it was on my son's birthday. And I was like, wow, Tom, you know, good memory, because that usually doesn't happen, especially when we were working together in a funny way. So that was really nice that he remembered. And he said, I remember you saying you can't work late. It's your son's birthday. You have to get home. And we finished our assignment and found our person. And I think it was a great start. Just really funny with the assumptions being made. And we took it from there. And this was a case that we worked on for a really long time. And we have a lot of stories related to this case. And it's probably one of the only cases that we worked on that we truly believe the person that was incarcerated was actually innocent. And he was released. And I can say that in my career, I never worked on a case that somebody was released that I actually felt they were the wrong person that was incarcerated. Many reasons for that. Sometimes people get released because maybe there was a technical issue, but the actual innocence, very hard to come across. And these types of cases, there are a lot of interviews and you really have to have an open mind. And I think what worked for Tom and I was that we have the same value system. We had pretty similar experiences growing up, meaning the same type of experiences where my father was a fireman, his father was a police officer, big Irish Catholic families. So I think that helped us in our like our ethics and our morals in investigating these cases. However, Tom and I, yes, there is a generational difference. I'm a lot younger. So we had very different perspectives on things. And I think that that helped. So having the foundation that was similar, I think was really important to our success as partners, as friends, as colleagues and as investigators. And then our differences with our ages and our point of view. Because I think we would be considered generationally like in different categories, you know, how they have boomers, Gen X, I think we would be. And as Tom said, he worked with a lot of older people before. And this was his first time working maybe with somebody younger and a female? Like, I'm not sure, Tom, we talked about it. You might have had a couple of female partners, but I don't know for any length of time. And I really only had female partners at the state's attorney's office. You went out with different investigators, and but working in an office and working out on the street, it's a different level. You need that level of comfort that this person has your back. This person, you know, will take a bullet for you, and vice versa. And also, too, not put you in a situation, like I said earlier, about compromising your morals or your ethics. And that was really, really important. And so we didn't agree on everything, but we challenged each other and we respected each other. And one of the things that Tom told me, which always sat with me, and I don't know if he learned it at Chicago or on when he was teaching, was about setting your ego aside and putting the mission of the case first and each other. And that really, really helped our partnership, because it was nice when you got acknowledged when you did something. But that wasn't the goal. The goal was that we wanted to find the people that we were told to locate. We wanted them to talk to us. Of course, we wanted the truth. But there were many steps leading up to that. And I think the rapport Tom and I had with each other, it was good. We could laugh about a lot of our differences and our similarities. And one of the similarities that we talked about one day was we both have brothers named Patrick, and they're born on the exact same day in the exact same year. So that was pretty funny. And I think Tom could set the stage too of how our office was set up. That's something we can talk about, because our desks faced each other so that we could look at each other. And when you're speaking, and maybe that person really doesn't like your idea and they make one of those faces, you know, you could really tell. And like I said to you, Mike, earlier, that it's good that we could see each other, because body language is so important. And that's so important when you're working out on the street, too, because people are going to say something to you like, oh, yeah, I'm not going to hurt you, or yeah, as they're, you know, going for their gun. So Tom really did teach me a lot and brought me into going for my certified forensic interviewing designation. So he challenged me in that way, and just always learning. So,
There's so much, like, I could talk to you for 3 hours just based off of that answer alone. I am sorry that you had to look at Tom every day when you sat at your desk. I don't know who you upset to pull that assignment, but I feel for you. That's going to be my last joke, Tom. She already talked about how big you are. So I'm
gonna you had a few before. In fact, I'm glad you said, you know, she talked about how big I was and intimidating. And I have to admit, I can be intimidating. And that's one of the benefits that Joanne and I have when we're working together, because it really softens people's view of me when we walk in a male and a female together in a situation. And we've had people, and I can't get into too many details, but there was one situation where we had to go down to a street that was a lot of crime occurring in that area. And being both Caucasians and male and a female, we were advised that it might be better to find another team to go down there that would be accepted more by the community. And it's funny, because we went down there and the person came to the window and said, we identified ourselves and asked to come up. Oh, yeah, I'll be right down. You know, we had no issue at all. The woman sat us down, and we had a very fruitful discussion with the person. So it is an advantage. I feel it's an advantage for a male and a female for various reasons to be working together. But as far as the intimidation factor, and I do recall when I worked for Wicklander and Zelowski, that they had a person there that was makes me look like it's a little brother when I'm standing next to him. And I'm sure you recall Brett, But he could be very intimidating. And what Brett did was he would just lower his voice, you know, and he would talk a lot softer manner, and slow the conversation down. And he was very successful at that. And I learned a lot from Brett, you know, and how to reduce the intimidation factor. But
it's funny to hear somebody refer to you and Brett as potentially intimidating. You're both big guys for sure. And we've had Brett on, and Brett's a very close friend of mine. But you're two of the nicest guys I've ever met in my entire life by a landslide. So to even think about either one of you outside of your, you know, physical size being intimidating, I just think is hysterical. But you made a great point there about how I'm sure on approach, managing first impressions, just getting somebody's buy-in. Joanne, you mentioned it. We love the truth, but we have to talk to each other first to even have a chance of getting to the truth after. So whether you're managing space, whether you're managing positioning, I'm sure you both took turns managing who was the lead or who was the note taker or how you played off of each other. So, and Joanne, to go back to your answer too, when you talked about having a shared value system, but also having different perspectives. So I'm guessing that the shared value system allowed for a lot of that rapport and respect and appreciation of the different perspectives. And to give Tom credit, because I've taken a couple shots at him, because where we come from, that's just how friends talk to friends. So I don't really know any other way. But to hear you talk about how he remembered your son's birthday and how he did go out of his way to train and to educate and to help, you know, that's the Tom that I've always known as well. Joanne, you talked about that first case that you both worked together where you worked really hard for a long time. There was a lot of interviewing involved, and essentially, if I heard it right, was able to prove that somebody was innocent and should no longer be incarcerated. And I do want to call that out because that's one of the reasons, Tom, why I'm so proud of the group that you and I worked with together, because that's a group that really prioritizes the truth over all else. And if a mistake has been made, let's make it right. If somebody is innocent, let's get them out of the investigation. It's not about necessarily confirming guilt or closing cases. It's about learning the truth first and foremost. So Joanne, to kick it back to you for a second, and I'm sure there's details you can't share, and I certainly wouldn't ask for any of those, but you mentioned keeping an open mind. So with all of the interviews that you both did in that specific case, how did you work together to keep an open mind, as I'm sure details and understanding was changing in real time throughout the interview process?
Yes. And you're right. There was a lot of people on the other side being like, okay, this person isn't innocent. Everything pointed to them, all of those type of things. But you kind of had to, like an onion, peel things back. And a lot of these cases, again, too, were much older. They were, you know, 10, 15, 20 years old when you're going back to reinvestigate some of these cases. And things were done differently then. And, but in leading up to going to interview people, like you said, say Tom's stature or different things, Tom and I would always get together. Like I said, our desks faced each other, and whoever we needed to interview that day, we would look at who the person was and try to know as much as we could about them, about what they said, maybe their relationship with the police. You know, we would look at maybe gender and different other factors, cultural factors, to see who would better be the person to initially be the lead on that. And not that that always worked, because there could have been a time where I said, okay, based on all these factors, how about I conduct the interview and you're the note taker? I'll be the lead on it because it looks like I can develop rapport quicker. And, rapport might already be there. Like sometimes, okay, I like to get my nails done. And sometimes there are some women, they, you know, they like to get their nails done too. And we're going to talk to a witness and I may comment on their nails. And that's just like an instant rapport. Sometimes with women, I hate to say that, you might compliment their hair, different things. So Tom and I would discuss that and then prepare for the interview, you know, the meat of the interview. And, we would schedule it for that way. However, sometimes the person didn't like me. I broke rapport or something just happened. And I had to put my ego to the side and think about what would best get this person to open up, to feel comfortable and speak with us at least. And Tom and I, again, would speak about in our preparation, if that happens, we didn't do it obviously where I would say, oh, I know you don't like me, so talk to my partner. It would be a little more subtle where we could pick up that from each other. And then Tom might, you know, throw in something and kind of see if rapport could be built back up. And that went seamless. And that was for all the types of cases that we did. And we did work on some pretty serious murder cases, not just post-conviction cases where you're reinvestigating, but also cases that were in the system that were very serious, usually double homicides, quadruple homicides, that they were having difficulty finding witnesses. Because sometimes when a case starts out, it could be in 2000, and by the time it's going to trial, it's in 2005. And a lot of those witnesses are in the wind. And Tom and I worked on a case, a quadruple murder, and one of their main witnesses, maybe 6 months before trial, was in the wind. And Tom and I were given that challenge. And it was a challenge. We crossed state lines to find this person. And I know I'm veering off to a totally different case here. You're asking me, but that's kind of sometimes my mind works. And Tom even said that to me, like, I'll start up this way, go this way. But I usually bring it back, you know, usually. So, but just kind of throwing out there about partnerships, where we would have to be flexible. Here you're working on a 20-year-old case, and they were all very serious cases, all murder cases. And then bring it up to speed on like here and now and how things are done now. So we had to be flexible. And again, that respect and cooperation. And we always love to learn. So if there was a class about something and we were working on something, we would reach out and be like, okay, we took some of those false confession classes, read different books, like the training, and we're just always seeking to challenge each other. And I think that was really good, because I think if you had, you know, partners that might not see the value of education, that would be difficult. Where I will admit, Tom is an avid reader, much better than I am. And he would read a book and then he'd be like, I'm sending you the book. And I would get the book, you know, right away. And that was really, really great.
I tell you what, you said a couple of things that I want to harp on real quick, if I can, and then we'll toss it back to Tom. One of the things that I love that I heard you say is when you both were, and I know it's one example and there are lots of other considerations, but when you were talking about selecting who the lead interviewer would be, one of the main considerations was who may have the best chance at building rapport. Mm-hmm. It wasn't who has the most experience, who's done this case before, or whose turn is it, or flip a coin, or I feel great today, I'm going to dominate this person. It was who has the best chance to build rapport the quickest. I think that is a phenomenal call out that some people might have missed. And it doesn't matter if it's an investigation, if it's a job candidate interview, if it's resolving workplace conflict, if you're trying to determine which business development associate is going to lead a conversation with a new customer, who has the opportunity to establish rapport the quickest is a very important consideration. I love hearing that. And I also want to illustrate for people that might not pick up on it, the difficulty of conducting interviews in cases that are 5 to 20 years old. I don't have that experience. You know, Tom, when we worked together, it wasn't uncommon for me to get cases that were 3 months old, 6 months old, a year old, maybe something like that. And that wasn't fun. But now to get into multiple homicides that are 5 to 15 years ago, maybe longer, and you factor in memory changes, you factor in just the sheer time, people's motivations to talk or not talk, how relationship dynamics changed along the way. The level of difficulty in those interviews is substantial. So which, Tom, leads me to a memory that I have, and I'm sure it's a different case entirely, so we don't need to get into detailed cases, but just to highlight it, I remember you and I were talking once, and you were talking to me, we were talking about the cognitive interview, and you were telling me how somewhere along the way, you helped resolve a homicide investigation because you were talking to somebody who claimed to be a witness, and you very patiently took their whole story and then asked them to draw a picture of where they were standing versus where the homicide occurred. And then how they drew it, literally like the stairwell or whatever it was in the building. I don't remember all the details, but it would have been physically impossible for them to see what they saw, what they said they saw, had they been standing where they were in the picture, which led you to determine that you actually had the suspect. And so to highlight like that level of detail orientation and that level of strategy and the types of cases you both were working, I think it's very important for the listeners to understand. So Tom, to kick it back to you, as you and Joanne were tracking people down, and I'm apparently asking each other for directions as you were going through Chicago, depending on who knew where who was.
We got GPS after that.
Nice. The Garmin when it first came out, something like that.
They're great. I still use it.
Nice. When you were first like chasing these people down, how did you work to build rapport and help people get comfortable telling the truth in a lot of these cases that were so old?
Well, one particular instance comes to mind, and Joanne and I sat down beforehand, and a little bit of the background was we're looking for a young man who was very cooperative in a case. And it was our job at the time to serve a subpoena for him to come to court. And we never foresaw any problem with this individual. So we found out that he was in the wind. He was involved in another case. He thought the police were looking for him, and he did not want to be found. These types of cases, I really enjoyed finding people that didn't want to be found. You know, so in fact, we jokingly called ourselves bound. What is it, Joanne? Dog the bounty hunter.
Okay, but you have to do your dog.
No, we're not going to get into that. But anyway,
I'll let you off the hook this time.
We couldn't find him, and which was very unusual for us because we usually always find people we're looking for. So we found out where his father lived. We went over to his father's house, and in our prior discussion, we determined that Joanne would be the better person to initiate this interview. Father came out on the front porch, and Joanne said, "We're here. We're trying to find your son. We have a subpoena. He's been cooperative before." The father went off on Joanne. He started yelling at her, and he says, "Why should I tell you anything?" He said, there was a murder in a nearby police area, and he got information who the offender was. He got the detectives involved, told the detectives, and they didn't do anything. They never got back to him. And Joanne said what most people would say. And in classes that I've been in front of, I bring up this situation. And I said, "What would you say?" And they said, "Just what Joanne said." But sir, we're not here about that right now. We have nothing to do with that case. So with this, I asked Joanne, and this is part of our communication. I said, "Joanne, do you mind if I say something?" And she says, "No, Tom, go ahead." She's glad to pass it off.
Yeah, help.
He's your problem now, dude.
I said, "I used to work in that area, that detective area," which I did. And I said, "I know those detectives over there." And I did. And I said, "Would you please tell me the information? Give me the information about that case. I'll find out who the detectives are. I'll talk to them, and I will find out and get back to you what happened on that case." And as he's telling me, he's giving me information, I'm writing it down, which is further showing him that I care about this information and helping him out. So he gave me the information. I did track down the detectives afterwards, found out what happened. I called back with him. And actually, his information wasn't any good at all. I had no intentions of giving this person details of the case, but it was enough to satisfy him. That little incident on the porch, he appreciated that so much that he got in our car. He took us to where his son lived on the far southeast side, and we were able to serve him the subpoena. The kid came to court, and everything worked out fine. But that's the value of rapport. And you got to let people vent. You got to listen to them, listen to their gripes, their beefs. And even though it's hard at sometimes because you have people screaming at you, you just have the ability to listen. And I think you'll get very far in life by just doing that.
Amen. What a perfect example for solve other people's problems before they can solve yours. Mm-hmm. If we were just focused on, hey, we're different people, we'll follow up. Your son's a great guy. He's just a subpoena. He's helped us before. The other dude is still wrapped up in his own problem. You help him solve that problem first, then he will help you solve your problem. That's a tremendous example of that.
Mike, do you mind if I follow up with another case? And Joanne will appreciate it.
Joanna, one that I did well on.
Yes, you did extremely well on this one.
Tom spent all night trying to remember the one time you needed his help in the whole entire time you worked together. He got it in there.
I would like to talk about a case where we had to go into a penitentiary and we had to talk to a very high-ranking gang member. And we discussed it so well. My history with Chicago and Joanne's history with adult probation, state's attorney's office, a little different coming up. And we discussed how should we approach this individual because we wanted some sensitive information from him regarding his involvement in a murder. And it wasn't, he was incarcerated, but his involvement was on the periphery. He made a phone call. And we decided Joanne would be the best to conduct the interview. So we went into the penitentiary, and all this discussion, Joanne said, you know, why don't we just wait and see what happens as far as handshaking and how we introduced ourselves to him. So we walked up to him, and the first thing he did was he put his hand out and shook our hands. And Joanne identified ourselves in the same way we always do. We say, give our names first and last. I'm Tom McGreal. I'm an investigator with the state's attorney's office. And then we show our IDs and make sure they look at them. Joanne does the same. I'm Joanne and Ryan, and I'm an investigator with state's attorney's office. So they don't absolutely know who we are and the reason we're there for. They put us into a small room where we conducted the interview. Joanne was sitting right in front of this individual and talking to him. And I was on the side, little bit to the rear. I had pushed my chair out. I was the note taker. So Joanne starts the interview with them, and I start writing on my notepad. With that, this guy, and he looks like Body by Pontiac. His shoulders are like this, and he turns and he looks at me like this. I immediately took the notepad over and flipped it. And there's going to be no notes in this interview because obviously he reacted to that. Yeah. And now, afterwards, we have to make sure as soon as we get in that car, we debrief. And we take our notes there in the car while our memories are still fresh, because memory starts degrading immediately after an interview. Now, Joanne conducted the interview. And one thing I would like to say is that I'm sitting there, and not only am I trying to recall what he's saying, but I'm watching his body language. And one thing bothered me. During the whole interview, he was talking to Joanne like this. And the prevailing theory at the time was that people are covering their mouth. They're trying to keep the words in. They don't want to say what they're saying. Mm-hmm. I don't believe that, you know, but there are different reasons for why would person cover their mouth. And one of the reasons would be they're lying. They don't want to let the words out of their mouth. Another reason would be they might have bad breath. And Joanne cleared that up. She said, no, he had bad teeth. And his teeth were terrible. And he was covering his mouth. It's braces would be another reason. A person with braces would cover their mouth because they're embarrassed, you know. But Joanne spotted that right away and cleared it up. And it was a very successful interview, which we learned a lot of lessons out of it.
That's awesome. And I love the little illustrations that are so important in all of these stories. You had plans going in, but you weren't necessarily married to one or the other. We've got a couple good options. Let's see how the introduction goes. And then based on that, we'll move. So you moved. Tom, in real time, you were like, oh, no notes today. But you and I have met plenty of investigators that wouldn't have done that. My job is to take notes. I'm taking notes. The notes are important. And that could have fractured the entire interview and you may have gotten nothing else out of them. So a great pivot, a great recognition there. And Joanne, I love the, not only that we used an example where you were quite successful this time. So
thank you, Tom.
Glad we got that out there. But also the contextual awareness with the body language. And I'm sure we probably feel similarly, but when we're evaluating somebody's nonverbal communication, even verbal, the context of the situation is the most important thing. Like one behavior doesn't always mean one or the other. He's covering his mouth because he's got busted teeth and he's sitting right across from a woman. He's probably self-conscious about that. Mm-hmm. My wife and I were laughing. We met with our son's teachers before school started this year. We went out to lunch first and she dripped salad dressing on her shirt. She's going to be so mad that I brought this up, by the way. I'm sorry, bro. So when we went in to meet with the teachers, she sat with her handbag on her lap and her arms around her handbag. And I'm laughing that how many people are looking at that thinking, well, she's very defensive and standoffish. No, she's embarrassed. She doesn't want you to see the salad dressing on her blouse the very first time you meet her. So having that contextual awareness is so very important. You guys have given a couple examples on being able to pivot during interviews as you were working back and forth. Was there ever a time where one of you, and I'm going to assume, Joanne, that you were the one that did this, that one of you realized that maybe the other interviewer was so focused that a door had opened and they just missed it? Maybe a word choice was used or a behavior changed or a detail dropped. And because as interviewers, we get so focused. Was there ever a situation where, Joanne, maybe you had to jump in at some point because Tom might have been so focused he missed the detail, where you were able to not only get the truth, but help, and I mean this in the most sincere way, help Tom like protect his self-image as the interviewer so you're not compromising one interviewer's credibility in order to get the truth from the subject?
That's a really good question. Nothing jumps out at me where that he was going down a wrong path. But there might have been occasions when we're in the car planning to go knock on a door and, you know, if somebody's in their head a lot and Tom might have been thinking about the next case and we're kind of in this case, but he's thinking about that case and we get out the door and start heading to the door and he's like, oh, yeah, I'm going to tell them whatever. And I would stop him and I was like, no, that's, you know, like for later. So I don't have any recollections of actually the other scenario presented. Tom, do you?
Yes, I do. In fact, it's not hard to recall because it's the same case. The penitentiary case that I was just talking about. When we were talking to this guy, it was a very successful interview. Joanne was doing great. And something was said. And she broke rapport. And he said, I'll go back now. I'm leaving. You know, and with that, I picked up and our transfers are seamless. And like most partners, you get to know what that other person is going to do or what's going on in their minds at the time. You know, and Joanne just thought the interview was over. And I brought up a topic. I said, do you think we just dropped out of the sky? Aren't you wondering all why we're here or how we came to be here? And he said, no, why? Why are you here? You know, how'd you get here? And I brought up a name of another detective who is very influential on the police department, very well respected by detectives and criminals also. And his face immediately lit up. Oh, how's he doing? And what's going on with him? And I said, well, we were talking about this case. And he said, you had a lot of knowledge about different things going on in the area. And he took that as a compliment. He talked to us for 30 to 45 minutes after that, which he was all ready to go back at the time. And that's the power of a transfer, but a seamless transfer. And we do it all the time. And Joanne can tell you funny stories about me where somebody didn't like me and started directing my questions to Joanne. And we're back to the ego thing. And I have no problem, you know, transfer it over, especially if somebody doesn't like me. But it does bother me sometimes that somebody would.
It did bother you. It did. We met this woman out on her lawn, and she had a bad experience with the police. And Tom, again, with like his stature, and he was trying to talk to her, and she was not having it. But she turned to me, and we were talking. And then later we got back to the office, and Tom was like, she didn't talk to me, you know, she didn't whatever. And I was like, Tom, that happens all the time, especially as a female in law enforcement, not so much on the street, but sometimes it was with the attorneys, that sometimes Tom had such a history coming from Chicago that he already had a well-established credibility. And although I worked in the same building at 26 in California as a probation officer, I didn't have the same relationships with state's attorneys at that time. And there was an instance that Tom and I were working on a case. It was a very important case, that quadruple murder. And the state's attorney sent over some paperwork and said, I want to have a meeting later. And Tom was engrossed in something else. So I said, you know, I'll read everything and I'll give you the Cliff Notes version. And he's like, okay. So I read everything. I'm like, okay, ready for this meeting. Tom was at his desk and he looks up and I said, okay, here's the deal. Here's the guy, blah, 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 blah. Tom's like, okay, we go into the meeting and the state's attorney, you know how like three people can be standing together, say like a triangle. Well, the state's attorney totally just faces Tom, like I'm not even there, starts talking about the case, talking about who we need to find and everything. And Tom is like, yes, okay, we're going to get him. Yes, I'm off to the side. I'm like, okay, you know, just listening. And it goes on for a little while and I'm patient. We walk out of the state's attorney's office, and it was a very unusual name of the person we had to find. I'll say Plato. Okay. We walk out of the state's attorney's office. As soon as we get out of the office, the door closed, Tom turns to me and goes, who the f- is Plato? And I was like, okay, here's such a, it's describing itself where I did a lot of the background work, fed it to Tom. Doesn't matter. The perception for some people would be that Tom's always the lead. Tom always knows more. He was, you know, the detective. He has the credibility. And in the beginning, it was easier for me to handle situations like that because I did have a lot more to learn and I was okay with that. But then later on, I mean, I made my own credibility and you have to start somewhere and stuff. And I wasn't angry at Tom that the state's attorney did that. But it made me like aware of how things are. And I think it's good to kind of know your environment. And especially at the state's attorney's office, there's many more female prosecutors, but there's very few female investigators. So, you know, just that whole perception with a man and woman team. And I'm saying that this might have been 10 years ago, maybe 10, even 15 years ago. Maybe, yeah, like when we initially
12 years ago. Yeah, it was 12. Around 12.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think things have changed. That was one thing that, you know, with different things and partnerships and stuff. And that was kind of funny where, and Tom played along, like he knew. He was like, oh, yeah, yeah. And I thought he did because I thought he actually listened to me. But obviously, he was just deer in the headlights to me, like, okay. And one of the other things, Mike, I wanted to point out too, a lot of this with communication and getting to the truth, at the time, we were working together, Tom's children older than mine. And mine was still like in grade school and high school. And so much of this material would relate to parenting and talking to your kids and all the different classes we went to and things like that. And my one daughter, who's older than my son, would call me Ninja Mom because, you know, you would figure out everything. And she would tell my son, well, you know, don't look at her or don't, you know, just funny things. And a lot of that I learned through going to classes, I went to different classes before and then eventually went to Wicklander. But also that was like with Tom and I sitting across from each other and mirroring and trying to find out, like, somebody says something. Okay, we would say, like, freeze your face. What are you thinking right now when you're saying that? So that we could kind of identify that in other people. Not that everyone's the same, but, you know, to understand how each other is feeling if we're not saying something, you know, if you're uncomfortable in a situation without saying it. I think you need to know that about the people you're with, like your partner in life, like your friends, and definitely, you know, your partner at work.
That's spectacular. Freeze your face. What are you thinking right now? I can just picture the first time one of you said to the other, freeze your face. Wait, right. What?
And we were in a cubicle. We were in a cubicle, Mike, where there were other investigators who thought we were nuts. They were like, oh my gosh, you know, but it was funny.
But it worked because now you're developing a level of skills that not only transitions to the interviews that you're conducting, because you're right, we're not the same. But you just get close. Like, as long as you're in the ballpark, I don't need to know word for word what you're thinking. But as long as I'm in the ballpark, I can work with that. But then also the ability to support each other. Mm-hmm. Like, Tom, you mentioned the smooth transitions. To be able to know, okay, that pause was 1/10 of a second longer than normal, so here I come. Or that the way that question was asked opens the door for me to come in. I feel like, and you're right, Tom, by the time you and I worked together, we were solo when we were doing the investigations for WZ. But prior to that, I did a bunch solo and I did a bunch with teammates as well. And I feel like one of the biggest mistakes we would run into, sometimes I feel like it was the co-dominant thing. You had two people who wanted to be like the head person in the interview. But I feel like more often than not, the interruptions were made with good intentions. Like, somebody wasn't trying to screw up their partner. Someone wasn't trying to be the all-star, but they just saw something and couldn't wait, or they heard something and just couldn't wait. And either they didn't have the self-control and or they didn't understand how their partner communicates enough to wait for the opportune window to chime in if necessary.
Absolutely.
So learning each other's emotions, learning the communication, setting up for those transitions, I think is spectacular. Tom, where you had, it sounds like, many more partnerships prior to working with Joanne, how did you really look to focus on learning her interview style so you could add to the interview as opposed to accidentally break rapport or ruin the opportunity to get the information?
It never came up. And I'll tell you why is Joanne is a fantastic interviewer. And I agree with everything she says, what she's doing. I never had a point where I said, you know, you broke the rapport in this conversation for this reason. But it's just, we have different backgrounds. We have a lot of fun. And when we're working, we laugh all day long. We laugh at ourselves. We laugh at others. And we really had very little disagreements because our styles, and it might have been the evolution of both of us on the job with different situations, but there was no problems that I can think of where the rapport was broken because of something that she did that was
I wouldn't even think that. We've all been in the chair where we've been thinking about our next question, or we were going down one line, we were following a road, and maybe the person taking notes can look at their notes and spot a pattern, or look at their notes and spot a change in information. Or maybe because I'm just purely listening and I don't have to worry about talking. I remember I was observing one case in Will County at the Sheriff's Department. And the woman who was the primary suspect who was being interviewed dropped a she where it should have been an I or me. And because I was the one who was in the witness seat, I was able, and thankfully I was in like the cool monitor room behind the glass that people only see on TV. So that was like my one time in that position.
Yeah,
I was able to tap the detective on the shoulder and go, yo, time out. You got to pull him out of it. It's probably her daughter. You just told me an hour ago she's got a 19-year-old daughter with similar social habits. But The only reason why I was able to do that was because I was fortunate enough to have no brain cells dedicated to talking at that time. They were all dedicated to listening. So it wouldn't be a rapport breaking scenario, but I'm sure there's times where just because we have the luxury of sitting and taking notes, we catch something.
Right.
But then because we get to know our partner, like either A, she's going to get to it, or B, if she doesn't, there'll be a natural transition time later where I can circle back for it. So I was curious about how we learn those natural transition times.
Well,
can I answer, Tom?
Please.
Yes, go ahead.
Can I answer? It's funny that you say that because if Tom's the note taker, he would, as he's taking notes, he would start to write down questions he thought I missed. And at the end of the interview, I would always say, Tom, is there anything you'd like to add? And either he would add something, but when we would debrief, he would show me a lot of times, oh, I had these questions, but you eventually got to them. So, I mean, that's one thing that you, I think that kind of answers your question to a degree. And I think if he felt he needed to interject at that time, he would. Like if it was something like you can't let the person kind of go way off topic and then trying to bring them back, it's harder. I think it's very, it was very few times where we would interrupt each other. We would do it in a nice way, like, oh, and some almost sometimes like a little Columbo kind of way, like, oh, I'm sorry. Could you rephrase that or something where it's not like, hey, you know, you forgot to ask this. It was way more subtle. And I don't know if I explained that right. Do you want to add anything, Tom?
No, I think that covers it. There's nothing that comes to mind right away.
And that's a perfect illustration. By the way, we'll pause and let all the younger investigators go to YouTube and watch Columbo highlights for 30 seconds so they can get the reference.
If they even know who Columbo is.
I love it. But that's also a perfect illustration to both of your credit. You'd worked together long enough that there's trust. Maybe I would ask a different question there. But my partner has a different routine. My partner takes a different road to get the same destination that I would. Uh-huh. So I'm going to be patient. I'm going to note that question just in case for some reason I've got to come back to it. But I have the trust in my partner that in this case, she is going to work her way there and get it. So it shows proficiency. It shows trust. And then Tom, on your side, it shows the patience and the self-confidence not to need to jump into that interview. Like I have a perfectly capable partner in the driver's seat right now. Let's give her every opportunity to land this thing. And then if not, I'll jump in at the very end. And Joanne, I love that. Not that either one of you need me to say what I appreciate that you did. But at the end, do you have any questions? So as partners, if you know that's coming, then there's almost no need for me to interrupt because I know at the end, Joanne's going to say, do you have any questions? And that gives me my chance. That is the same strategy to, you know, steal something that clearly you were doing far more effectively before me. But that's the same strategy that my wife and I use when we're negotiating on big purchases or when we have to go talk to teachers at school. Which one of us is going to go first and why? Okay, well, it's your ball until you turn around and hand it off. And then once you hand it off, do you have any questions? Did I miss anything? What haven't I thought about? Now the other one can come in. And it doesn't appear as strategic or pre-planned as it often is. It's just the natural handoff in the conversation. Earlier in different ways, kind of different stories. Tom, you mentioned sometimes how our feelings can get hurt a little bit if somebody doesn't want to talk to us. Doing the best we can. We're being respectful. We're being nice. You don't want to talk to me? I might be 6'24" tall, but I'm still a really nice guy. And Joanne, you mentioned, and I know it was 15 years ago, but that doesn't take away, you know, you're the one that did all the research. You're the one that is completely read in on the case, but yet the state's attorney is looking at Tom with a set of assumptions and not you, which no doubt hurts your feelings and creates an emotional experience, and rightfully so. So my question to you both, and answer it in whatever order, however you feel is appropriate, is how did you work to reinforce the trust and respect you had for each other and pick each other up when you knew that one of you felt insulted or disrespected or misunderstood throughout the years working together?
Do you mean by the state's attorney's office in large and community or each other?
with each other. So if you see that Tom's feelings are hurt, you know, how do you pick him up? How do you support him, Tom? If you see that Joanne was just slighted, you know, how do you kind of pick her up and help her feel better and continue? Because I'm sure, like, there's times in my relationship with my wife, who is by far the all-star of our family, I might miss something that upset her when it's my job to hopefully make sure that doesn't happen. But if it does, make sure that I pick her up and reaffirm how smart she is and how much I love her and how important she is and all of those things. So I'm curious, in your partnership, when you saw that happen, how you picked each other up and supported each other.
Okay. Well, I'm for sure, I could say, I don't recall exactly, but on that day, we probably had a really nice lunch and Tom paid. But Tom has always been really good at, you know, being frank with me regarding, say that incident or similar incidents. Part of it was that I would make the assumptions that people that worked at Chicago Police, they're retired, they have all this experience, they come over to our office, they must know more than me. I have my master's in criminal justice, and I was a probation officer for 10 years, but in my head, I valued their experience over mine. And Tom showed me that the kind of cases I worked on and things at the state attorney's office, they were very complicated cases, and that my work, he always validated the work. But also, if I needed correction, you need constructive criticism, and you need, you know, for somebody to say, oh, maybe there's a better way. How about trying this? But I think we could... We would realize if each other was having a rough day, and maybe if we didn't have an appointment already on the books, but we were planning to go do something that day that maybe the other person might not have been in the right framework, we would talk about it and be like, we can do that tomorrow. There's not a rush. It wasn't like we were responding in real time. Like, you get a call and you have to run out. Yeah, there were times like that where if somebody called us and said, oh, so-and-so's home now, we'd have to run out. But we did have the luxury of being able to plan our working on our investigations. And I think we would see how each other were doing that day, like emotionally, physically. You know, sometimes you push yourself, but I think we would see that and be like, nope, I think it might be a better time to do this. Or I hope I answered that question.
I think you did. Tom, anything you want to add?
Yes. As you can tell, Joanne talks, and she asks flat.
Have I been talking more?
No.
Did Clayton kiss the Blarney Stone? I am Irish.
That's right. No, but we spent so many hours in the car. Sometimes we drove to Missouri once. We go downstate to penitentiaries to conduct interviews. And we talked in that car nonstop, and it was about any topic at all. And if somebody wasn't feeling good about something, we discussed that also. It's just that and another thing is, if one of us was emotionally involved with something that made us feel bad, you know, when we're typing out maybe a text, we would run that text by each other. And because sometimes when you're texting emotionally, you know, you're not thinking straight. And we both kind of went along with each other's opinions. We put value in each other's opinions, and we listened to each other. I'd say at least 40 partners in Chicago, and, you know, where there was some you got along with, some you didn't get along with, you know, and partnerships that didn't work out broke up quickly, you know, and others lasted maybe years. You know, Joanne is the longest partner I've ever worked with. And I think it's because, as she described earlier, it's because our personalities are extremely similar and we believe in the same things. I can't think of any time where we had any type of a situation that would break us up, you know, as far as partners go. And as you can see today, it's here 2025, I retired in 2014, and we're still friends. You know, we still associate together. We go out with our spouses. We meet for dinner. We know each other's children. It's a great partnership. And most good partnerships, you know, there are very few difficulties, and they remain not only partners but friends for years.
So let's capitalize on that to bring this conversation home. Let's say that there are people listening, and I'm sure there are, who either have new work partnerships or could be soon finding themselves in new work partnerships, whether that's law enforcement, whether that's in business, that could take any form. It doesn't really make a difference. They're going to have to start working with somebody new. Tom, we'll start with you, and then Joanne, we'll go over to you. Tom, what advice would you have based on your years of experience for people to develop successful work partnerships together?
You have to just respect each other. And if a day comes up where a person is down, sometimes you just have to leave them alone. You know, it's let them work it out themselves. Other times you can talk it out. You know, we did talk out situations at times, not many that I can even think of now trying to recall, but you just have to respect each other. You have to take care of each other. And we've had situations where we've gone out on assignments and things just didn't seem right, you know, and we sense that, both of us, you know, and we tried to avoid things that would hurt the other, you know. And nowadays, anything, you could go to work in the morning and be indicted by the nighttime, you know, and you have to take care of each other, and you're all you have out there, you know. Otherwise, you're just floating in the wind.
Joanne.
Yeah. I totally agree with Tom, and to some, you know, to try to work with people that maybe have your same value system, your same morals. So I think that really helps. It doesn't matter that you have the same background or anything, but those core foundations, they run across, like, you know, all faiths and all cultures and things like that. So to find that common ground, because I think that's really important, because then you'll never be put in a situation morally or ethically. And I think that's a good bar to use.
I think that's a great way to put it. And as you've talked throughout the conversation, from respecting each other's opinions to capitalizing on shared backgrounds, and maybe it doesn't have to be as deeply shared, but just as human beings, we have different things that we share.
Right.
Capitalizing on that, giving each other space, respecting their opinions, giving each other feedback, but always focusing on what's the positive direction that we're working for together. What are the goals that we're trying to achieve together? And Tom, you said it best, you know, just take care of each other.
Take care of each other. Yes. And you have to both like to go out to lunch or breakfast or coffee, you know, like take your time.
We did eat good.
Yes. Very important.
And it sounds a little bit silly, but it is very important, because it's funny how sharing a meal changes the dynamics of the conversation in the relationship, from the setting of wherever you are to the food that you're eating and the expectations of the conversation. That's a really, really, really good point. So let's go out on that one. I think that's a great point. We'll use that to wrap it up. I can't thank you both enough for taking the time to be here today. Tom, I've known you for many years. Joanne, I've met you through Tom. Mm-hmm. I have the utmost respect for both of you as people, for the work that you have done. So thank you so much for all of your service and all that you've dedicated to your communities. I don't live in Illinois anymore, but out in Chicago and out in Illinois. Thank you for staying in touch. I really appreciate you having this conversation today. Please continue to take care of each other. And I look forward to hopefully seeing you both again very soon, maybe this fall, like we saw each other last fall. But I certainly look forward to the next time. Thank you both so much.
Thanks again.
Mike, take care.
Tom and Joanne, thank you both so much for another great conversation. This is a conversation I've been hoping to have with you two for a very long time, and I'm finally glad we had a chance to make it happen. Thank you so, so very much, just for taking the time out of your day and telling your story, but being so open about the relationship you had and how you worked so well together for so many years. Thank you. Your points about having a shared value system are so very important for us all to consider, understand, and apply to our lives. and how you were supporting and learning from each other. You had different backgrounds and experiences professionally and kind of made some assumptions, right, wrong, good or bad about each other, but then learned to work through that and really help and support each other, taking advantage of those different perspectives that you had. And I love how you talked about preparing for your interviews, and it's not who's going to get the confession, but it's who's got the best chance to build rapport with this person. That was a fantastic approach. I truly love and appreciate that. And thank you so much for the time you spent with us today. And I guess the real lesson learned is when in doubt, Tom buys lunch and everything's better after that. But thank you guys so much. And of course, thank you to everybody that took the time to listen to the conversation today. We truly appreciate you all being here. Thank you so very much. Before you head out, please take a second to like the show, share the show, subscribe to it so you know when the next one's coming out. Leave us your feedback so we know what you want to hear more and less of, so we can provide it for you. Thank you all so very much. And also, while you're online, real quick, head over to our sponsors. Check out humantel.com for all you need to know about starting your education on identifying when people's emotions are changing through identifying shifts in their facial expressions and nonverbal communication. While you're there, enter the code INQUASIVE25 for 25% off the best-in-class online training at humantel.com. For the professional interviewers that just listened to a conversation largely about interviewing and investigating, head over to the International Association of Interviewers. All three of us, our members are over there. All three of us have our certified forensic interviewer designations. You can go over to certifiedinterviewer.com and learn more about how you can capitalize on the same opportunities. And while you're online, please check out inquasive.com to learn more about the programs that our clients ask us to customize and facilitate for their senior leaders, sales teams, and HR teams to teach them how to encourage people to share sensitive information under vulnerable circumstances in the face of consequences and all of our high-value daily conversations. Thank you all again for being here this week. We really appreciate it. Stay safe, take care of each other, and we'll see you next time.